While Diedrich was risking his life inside Nazi Germany, a young woman was growing up in a very different world. Her name was Maria von Wiedemar, and this is her story. I'm Laura Lee Siemens, and this is the Church History Podcast. Welcome back to our podcast. We missed the last 2 weeks. We had Canada Day and July 4th. So happy birthday to Canada and America. We also had our daughter's wedding. So it's been a very, very exciting and lovely, wonderful time here in our home. And today we are starting the first day of camp, and we're going to have 6 weeks of camp. So you can be praying for us. If you have been following along in this podcast, you'll know that I am now a children's pastor at our church. And so we have a fun summer of camp with the kids. So we're pretty excited about that. But I am going to continue and try to, as often as possible, hopefully still once a week, get our podcast in. So today we're telling the story of Maria von Wiedemar, and we're continuing and actually finishing our story as well this week on Diedrich Bonhoeffer. So we've done quite a few episodes on him already in the past, so you can go back and listen to those if you want to continue on with our story and hear it right from the beginning. All right, let's dive into today's episode. Born in 1924 on her family's estate in the Neumark region of Brandenburg, Marie entered a world of old Prussian traditions, sprawling farmland, and deep Christian faith. She was the third of seven children, born to Hans, a respectful landowner and gentleman farmer, and his wife, Ruth. The family belonged to Germany's old Prussian nobility. Through their extended family, they were connected to some of Germany's most influential names, including relatives of the great statesman Otto von Bismarck. Duty, honor, education, and service to God and country were woven into everyday life. Maria's childhood looked nothing like the crowded streets of Berlin. She grew up surrounded by open fields, forests, horses, rhythms of country life. The family estate was filled with siblings laughing, chores to be done, books to be read, and evenings spent together. It was the kind of place where children climbed trees, explored the countryside, and dreamed about the future. But Maria's generation would not be allowed an ordinary future. By the time she reached her teenage years, Adolf Hitler had transformed Germany. War had spread across Europe, families were being divided, and even the quiet estate of Prussia could not escape the reach of the Nazi regime. Maria had no idea that somewhere in Berlin, a pastor named Diedrich Bonhoeffer was fighting a secret war against Hitler, and Diedrich had no idea that God was preparing to bring into his life the woman who would become the love of his life. You are 12 years old. Your grandmother's house is always full of interesting people, pastors, professors, even military officers. Family friends who stay for hours, talking about theology, politics, and the future of Germany, while you sit quietly nearby, pretending not to listen. But today is different. A young pastor has come to teach your older brother and several of your cousins as they prepare for confirmation. His name is Diedrich Bonhoeffer. You've heard the adults talk about him before. They say he's brilliant. He studied in America. He speaks several languages. Some even say he's one of the brightest young theologians in Germany. You peek into the room. He doesn't look particularly intimidating. Round glasses, a calm smile, a stack of books under his arms. You wonder if perhaps you could join the class too. After all, you're almost old enough. Your grandmother, Ruth, thinks it's a wonderful idea, and she walks over to Diedrich. Would you consider allowing Maria to join the class? She asks. Diedrich smiles politely. Perhaps, he replies, let me speak to her first. Your heart races. This feels important. Sit across from the famous young pastor as he asks you questions. Questions about the Bible, about your faith, and about why you want to be confirmed. You answer the best you can. He listens carefully. Then he smiles kindly. I'm sorry, Maria, he says. You're simply not ready yet. Not ready? The words sting. You are disappointed, kind of embarrassed. Everyone else gets to stay. You have to leave the room. As you walk away, you probably have no idea that this quiet pastor would one day become one of the most important people in your life. And Diedrich certainly had no idea either. To him, Maria is simply an energetic 12-year-old girl who needs a few more years to grow up before confirmation. Neither of them could imagine the little girl leaving the room that day would one day become the woman he would ask to marry him. But before that could happen, Germany would descend into darkness, and both of their lives would be changed forever. 7 years have passed, and the world has changed. The cheerful confirmation class at Grandmother Ruth's house feels like a lifetime ago. Back then, Germany was still a nation struggling to recover from World War I. Adolf Hitler was simply one of many politicians making promises. Most people believed the future would somehow work itself out. Now, everything is different. Hitler rules Germany with absolute authority. The swastika hangs from government buildings, schools, and even many churches. The church itself has been torn apart. On one side stands the Reich Church, controlled by the Nazi government. Many of its pastors have embraced Hitler as Germany's God-appointed leader. Nazi flags hang beside the cross. Congregations begin services with Heil Hitler. Christians of Jewish ancestry are forced out. Parts of scripture that seem too Jewish have been taken out of the Bible. On the other side stands the Confessing Church, a much smaller group of pastors who refused to surrender the church to the state. They boldly declare that Jesus Christ, not Adolf Hitler, is the head of the church. Their sermons are watched. Their phones are tapped. The seminaries are closed, and many are arrested. One of those pastors is Dietrich Bonhoeffer. He is no longer simply a brilliant young theologian teaching confirmation class. He is now one of the most watched church leaders in Germany. His books have been banned. His preaching has been silenced. The Gestapo watches his every move. And unknown to almost everyone around him, he's now living a double life, as a pastor serving Christ and as a member of the German resistance. Neither Dietrich nor Marie could have imagined that the little girl he once thought too immature for confirmation would soon walk back into his life. This time, she would not be 12 years old, and this time, everything would be different. 7 years after that first awkward meeting, Dietrich and Maria met again. This time, they were not in a formal setting of confirmation lessons. Dietrich had gone to Ruth's farm, the country home of Maria's grandmother, for a writing retreat. The estate offered something rare in wartime Germany, quiet. Fields stretched beyond the houses, meals were shared around tables, conversation moved from theology, family, and the growing darkness overtaking the nation. And there was Maria. She's no longer the little girl Dietrich had once dismissed as too immature for confirmation class. She's 18 now, graduated from high school. She's thoughtful, intellectual, serious, and still full of life. And Dietrich was 36, twice her age, carrying the weight of war, resistance, secrecy, and danger. On paper, they seemed unlikely, but as they spent time together, something unexpected began to form between them. They talked easily. Maria was drawn to Dietrich's mind, his faith, and his seriousness about the world. Dietrich was drawn to Maria's warmth, courage, and clarity. She was young, but she was not shallow. She understood more than people expected. She had grown up quickly in a Germany where childhood did not last long. Grandmother noticed. Ruth had always respected Dietrich deeply. She saw the connection forming between him and Maria. Before long, she began encouraging it. A conversation here, a well-timed invitation there. The grandmother who once asked Dietrich to include Maria in confirmation class now wondered whether God had perhaps brought them together for something far greater. But war does not allow love stories to unfold gently. Shortly after Dietrich and Maria were reintroduced, devastating news came. Maria's father, Hans, had been killed in battle. Grief fell heavily over the family. Maria was only 18. In a matter of days, the possibility of romance, laughter, and new affection was overshadowed by death. And for Dietrich, the loss carried another weight. He was falling in love with a young woman whose world had been shattered by the same war he was secretly trying to end. The news reached the family. He had died serving his country, but fighting in a war none of them agreed with. Dietrich immediately sat down to write. He wrote to Maria. He wrote to her brothers. His words were full of admiration for their father. He spoke of Hans as a man of deep faith, man who loved God, loved his family, and loved Germany. Dietrich understood there was nothing wrong with loving your country. Hans had served because he believed it was his duty and because he had been forced to. He was an honorable man caught in a terrible time in history. Before Maria's mother read Dietrich's letter, however, someone else spoke to her. Maria's grandmother, Ruth, very gently, shared what she had begun to suspect. She believed Dietrich and Maria were falling in love. The room fell silent. Maria's mother could hardly believe what she was hearing. Her husband had only just been killed. The family was grieving. Maria was only 18 years old. Dietrich was 36, a pastor, and a man under constant surveillance of the Gestapo, a leader in the resistance against Hitler. To Maria's mother, it was unthinkable. She feared for her daughter. She feared the attention Dietrich attracted. She feared any future with him would be filled with danger, uncertainty, and heartbreak. Instead of reading Dietrich's comforting letter as a grieving friend, she now saw it through completely different eyes. And not long afterward, she wrote Dietrich herself. Her message was unmistakably clear. He was not welcome. He was not to come to the funeral or to any family gatherings. As far as Maria's mother was concerned, whatever affection had begun between the two of them needed to end immediately. Dietrich had faced opposition from Hitler. He had faced opposition from the German church. But now, for the first time, he faced opposition from the family of the woman he loved. And this battle would prove every bit as painful as the others. Dietrich was stunned. The letter from Maria's mother left him confused and hurt. He had written because the family was grieving. He had written because Maria and her brothers had lost their father. He had written because Hans had been a man worthy of honor. Why was he suddenly unwelcome? And why had he been forbidden from attending the funeral? Dietrich didn't understand. He had no idea that Maria's grandmother, Ruth, had been quietly watching him and Maria together. He didn't know. She had noticed their easy conversations, their laughter, their shared seriousness, and the way Dietrich seemed unusually alive in Maria's presence. So Dietrich wrote to Ruth, and then the whole story came out. Only then did Dietrich realize that Maria's grandmother had seen something he thought he had hidden, perhaps hidden even from himself. Maria had struck him, not only of her beauty, though he had noticed that too, but of her mind. Their conversations had surprised him. Maria was young, but she was so thoughtful, intellectual, and spiritually serious. She asked good questions. She listened carefully. She had a depth that stirred something in him. Dietrich, who lived every day surrounded by secrecy, danger, theological arguments, and political resistance, had found in Maria something bright and unexpected. She inspired him. And now, because of Ruth's matchmaking and her mother's alarm, Dietrich was forced to admit what he barely allowed himself to consider. He had fallen in love. From that day forward, Dietrich began writing to Maria's mother. He understood her concerns. If he had been in her place, he probably would have felt the same way. There was obvious issues. Dietrich was 36, Maria was only 18. An 18-year age difference was enough to make any parent hesitate. But that was not what frightened her the most. The greater danger was Dietrich himself. By now, rumors were circulating. People knew he opposed Hitler. Many suspected he was involved in something deeper than anyone could prove. To marry Dietrich Bonhoeffer was not to simply marry a pastor. It was to marry a marked man. Maria's mother feared what might happen to her daughter. What if the Gestapo arrested Dietrich? Would Maria be arrested too? What if the conspiracy against Hitler was discovered? Would she become the wife of a traitor? And what if Dietrich was executed? Would her daughter become a widow before she had even begun married life? These were not imaginary fears. These were the realities of Nazi Germany. Dietrich did not argue with her. Instead, he patiently answered her letters. He assured her that his feelings for Maria were sincere. He explained that he loved her deeply and would never intentionally put her in harm's way. He knew the risks better than anyone, but he believed that some things were worth risking everything for. As the months passed, Maria's mother watched her daughter. She saw that this was not a childish infatuation. Maria loved Dietrich. not because he was famous, not because he was brilliant, but because she admired his character, his courage, and his unwavering commitment to Jesus Christ. And Dietrich loved Maria with the same sincerity. For the first time in years, amid conspiracies, secret meetings, and growing horrors of war, he found himself dreaming about a future, a home, a family, what life would be like after the war. Finally, Maria's mother gave her blessing, and on January 13, 1943, Dietrich and Maria became officially engaged. It should have been one of the happiest days of their lives, but even as they celebrated their future together, Dietrich was moving even deeper into a conspiracy that made it increasingly unlikely he would live to see their wedding day. By the time Dietrich and Maria became engaged, the resistance had reached a terrible conclusion. Hitler had to die. But before anyone agreed to participate in such an act, they asked a question that weighed heavily on every conscience in the room. Were they simply acting out of political disagreement? Was this nothing more than one group of Germans trying to replace another? Or had Hitler committed crimes so monstrous that removing him had become a moral duty? For Dietrich, this was not an abstract theological discussion. It was personal. His own family had spent years gathering evidence. His brother-in-law worked inside the German government. Hans, in particular, had carefully preserved documents that the Nazis hoped no one would see. Orders, reports, witness statements, lists of deportations, and records of murders. The evidence was overwhelming. They knew what had happened to the people with disabilities. Families had been told their sons and daughters were being transferred to special treatment centers where they would receive expert medical care. Instead, they were taken to killing centers. They were murdered and their bodies were cremated. Their ashes mailed back to grieving families along with official letters claiming their loved ones had died of pneumonia, heart failure, or other sudden illnesses. The entire program was built on deception. The government lied, the doctors lied, death certificates lied, even the funerals were a lie. And then there was the Jewish people. For years, the Nazis had isolated them, stripped them away from their rights, seized their businesses, and forced them into ghettos. Now, the persecution had become systematic extermination. Hans' documents told the story. Entire villages marched to ravines and shot by mobile killing squads. Families disappeared into ghettos where starvation and disease were the weapons. Extermination camps were opening day and night. By this point in history, historians estimate that roughly 2 to 2.5 million Jewish men, women, and children had already been murdered. The killing had accelerated dramatically after Germany invaded the Soviet Union in 1941. Entire communities were wiped off the map. Places like Baba Yar had become symbols of unimaginable evil, where more than 33,000 Jews were murdered in just 2 days. Meanwhile, camps were turning into industrialized murder under government policy. Dietrich read these reports, and he knew they were true. This was no longer a dictator improvising political opponents. This was a government deliberately murdering innocent people on a massive scale. The men in the resistance understood that if they acted, history might remember them as traitors. But if they failed, they would certainly die. But what if they did nothing? Millions more could die instead. For Dietrich, the question became almost unbearable. Could a Christian take one guilty life in an attempt to save countless innocent ones? It was a question he never wanted to face, but history had placed it before him, and now he had to answer it. The evidence did not stop with the deportations or the euthanasia programs. More reports continued to arrive. The resistance learned that concentration camps were becoming places of unimaginable cruelty. Prisoners were no longer simply being imprisoned or worked to death. They were being used as human test subjects. Doctors, men who had been sworn to heal the sick, were instead using innocent people for horrific medical experiments. Among the most infamous was the SS physician named Joseph Mengele. He became known as the Angel of Death. He greeted frightened families arriving on the train, deciding with a wave of hand who would be sent to forced labor and who would be sent immediately to the gas chambers. He was obsessed with twins. Children were separated from their parents and taken to laboratories where they endured endless measurements, blood tests, painful injections, surgeries that were medically unnecessary, and experiments designed to support Nazi racial theories. If one twin died, the other was murdered as well, so their bodies could be compared during autopsies. He also targeted children with unusual physical characteristics. He attempted to change eye color by injecting chemicals into children's eyes. He collected organs and body parts for research. Other prisoners were subjected to sterilization experiments, unnecessary surgeries, and procedures performed without anesthesia. These were not isolated acts of cruelty by just one disturbed man. They grew out of the same poisonous belief that had fueled Hitler's entire movement, that some human lives are more valuable than others. For Diedrich, every new report reinforced the same conclusion. When a government decides that one group of people is less than human, there is almost no limit to what it will justify. First came discrimination, then exclusion, then deportation, then murder, then medical experiments carried out in the names of science. The men in the resistance did not need to imagine what Hitler's government might become. They were reading the reports. They were seeing the evidence. And every page made it more urgent. So, it was clear, Hitler deserved death. But the next thing they had to be sure of was that if they assassinated Hitler, it would even make a difference. If others would step up and take Hitler's place and continue the horrors, then the assassination would not be just. But the group found people high in the government who loved Germany, wanted to see Germany succeed, but found the actions of Hitler vile and wanted to end the Nazi Party. They also made deals with Britain, and if they were able to assassinate Hitler, they would be able to end the war. So after careful discussion and prayer, Diedrich Bonhoeffer, who was a pacifist, signed up to help assassinate Hitler. By 1943, talking about removing Hitler was no longer enough. The resistance had decided it was time to act. The plan was daring. If everything went perfectly, Adolf Hitler would be dead within hours. If anything went wrong, every man involved would be executed. Inside of Germany's military service, a small circle of trusted officers quietly prepared what became known as Operation Flash. Among them were men Diedrich knew well, including his brother-in-law, Hans. There was also a colonel named Henning, and men who had reached the same terrible conclusion as Diedrich. Hitler could not be allowed to live. Imagine the tension. There's no loud speeches. There's no dramatic announcements. There's a handful of men in a quiet room speaking in hushed voices, knowing that if one person betrayed them, they would disappear into a Gestapo prison before sunrise. The plan seemed almost impossible. Hitler would be flying back from the Eastern Front. One of the men would place what appeared to be an ordinary package aboard the Führer's airplane, but inside that package, a bomb. The explosive was carefully hidden to avoid suspicion. The detonator was timed. The calculations were checked again and then again. There would not be a second chance. The package was loaded. The airplane's engines roared to life. The men watched as Hitler's aircraft lifted into the sky. Then they waited. Every passing minute felt like an hour. Somewhere high above Europe, the timer should be counting down. Soon, the bomb should explode. The plane should disappear from the sky. The war might end. The men waited for news. There was nothing. An hour passed, still nothing. Then the report arrived. Hitler's plane had landed safely, with no explosion, no fire, no crash, and no one knew why. Only later did they discover the terrible truth. The detonator had failed. The freezing temperatures in the aircraft's cargo had prevented the mechanisms from working. The bomb had become nothing more than a harmless package. But the package was still sitting on Hitler's airplane. If someone opened it, the conspiracy would be exposed. The Gestapo would begin arresting people within hours. One of the men quickly raced to recover the package before anyone discovered its contents. Somehow, against all odds, he retrieved the bomb and replaced it with an ordinary parcel. The evidence disappeared, and for a moment, the resistance was safe. Dietrich knew about the plot. Although he had not planted the bomb himself, he understood what had just happened. They had come within inches of changing history. But instead, Hitler was still alive. So the first attempt had failed. Hitler was alive, and for a brief moment, it seemed as though the resistance might just abandon the idea altogether. But every day they waited, more people died. So they began planning again. This time, the plan was even more desperate. Colonel Rudolf Christian von Gestorff volunteered for what everyone in the room understood would be a one-way mission. There would be no escape and no rescue and no second chance. He would die alongside Hitler. On March 21st, 1943, Hitler was scheduled to tour an exhibition in Berlin showcasing captured Soviet weapons. Thousands of soldiers had died capturing these tanks, artillery pieces, and equipment. Hitler planned to walk through the displays while military officers stood nearby explaining Germany's victories. Rudolf Christian would be one of those officers. But hidden beneath his uniform were two bombs, not designed to be thrown and not hidden in packages, attached to his own body. Before Hitler arrived, he would quietly activate the fuses. The clock had started. He knew exactly what it meant. In a few minutes, both he and Hitler would be dead. He took his place, and the doors opened. Hitler entered the exhibit. Every heartbeat mattered. Christian was walking right beside him, trying to remain calm while the explosives were ticking beneath his clothes. He answered questions, pointed to captured weapons, waiting for the right moment, any second now. Then something completely unexpected happened. Hitler suddenly changed his plans. Instead of spending half an hour touring the exhibit as scheduled, he rushed through it in just a few minutes, and without warning, he turned and headed for the exit. Christian froze. The timer was still running. He could not chase Hitler through a crowd. He could not explode in the middle of innocent soldiers and civilians. And if anyone discovered the bombs, the entire resistance network would be exposed. As calmly as he could, Christian excused himself. He hurried to the nearest washroom. His hands shook as he knelt over the explosives. Seconds remained. One wrong move, one slip of the hand, one mistake. But finally, the detonators were disarmed, and he breathed a sigh of relief. Hitler drove away completely unaware that he'd come within minutes of death. Once again, the resistance had failed, and once again, the men returned home carrying an unbearable question. How many more opportunities would they have? Because every failed attempt made Hitler more suspicious. The Gestapo tightened its investigations. Trust was becoming harder to earn. The resistance was running out of time, but they were not going to stop trying. The Gestapo was getting closer, and every failed assassination attempt was tightening Hitler's security. Every arrest uncovered another name. Every interrogation threatened to expose the entire network. Then, on April 5th, 1943, the knock finally came. The Gestapo arrested Dietrich Bonhoeffer. It had been less than 3 months since he and Maria had become engaged. They had barely begun dreaming about a life together, their wedding, a home, children, a future after the war. Now, all of those dreams were interrupted by the sound of prison doors closing behind him. At first, the charges seemed minor. The authorities believed Dietrich had abused his position to help several Jewish people escape Germany through what had been known as Operation 7. We talked about that in our previous episode. Remarkably, they did not know the full truth. They had no idea Dietrich was connected to a conspiracy to kill Hitler. The ignorance probably saved his life for a time. Dietrich was taken to a military prison in Berlin. Life was difficult, but not hopeless. He was allowed books to read, and he was allowed to write. And most importantly, Maria was allowed to visit. About once a month, she would walk through the prison gates, a young woman now 19, visiting the man she hoped to marry. Imagine those meetings. A guard unlocked the heavy steel door. For a brief hour, they could sit together, talk about ordinary things. Family, books, faith, the future. They tried to pretend prison was only temporary. When the visits ended, another guard would open the door. Maria would stand, and neither of them would know if they would ever see each other again. The door closes. The footsteps fade down the hallway, and Diedrich is alone. Between these visits, he wrote letters. Some of the most beautiful letters Diedrich ever wrote came from that prison cell. They spoke about hope, about suffering, about trusting God when the future could not be seen, about the home they still dreamed of building together when the war was finally over. For a while, it seemed possible. Perhaps he would survive. Perhaps the evidence against him was not strong enough. Perhaps he would eventually be released. Then everything changed. On July 20th, 1944, another group made one more attempt to kill Hitler. The resistance had failed. A bomb on Hitler's plane, a suicide mission inside a Berlin museum, both had come within inches of changing history. Now there was one final attempt. It was July 20th, 1944. Deep inside Hitler's military headquarters, known as the Wolf's Lair, senior officers gathered around a large conference table. Maps covered the wall. Military reports lay scattered across the room. Hitler stood at the center, discussing the rapidly collapsing war effort. Standing among the officers was Colonel Claus von Stauffenberg. Unlike the others, he was carrying much more than military papers. Hidden inside his briefcase was a bomb. Months earlier, Stauffenberg had been severely wounded in North Africa. He had lost his right hand, two fingers on his left hand, and an eye. Even arming the explosive was a painful, painstaking task. Somehow, using only the fingers he had left, he prepared the bomb. He quietly slipped the briefcase beneath the conference table, only a few feet from Hitler. Then he made an excuse to leave the room. Outside, every step felt heavier than the last. Behind him, the meeting continued, and inside the briefcase, the clock was counting down. The conspirators had planned everything. The moment Hitler was killed, Operation Valkyrie would begin. Reserve army units throughout Germany would seize government buildings. SS leaders would be arrested. The Nazi government would collapse from within. The war, they hoped, might finally come to an end. Then, an explosion ripped through the Wolf's Lair. The blasts shattered windows. Smoke and splintered wood filled the room. The heavy oak conference table exploded into pieces. Officers were thrown against the room. Several men killed instantly. Stauffenberg saw the explosion from the distance. Certainly, Hitler was dead. He hurried from the headquarters and flew back to Berlin. The resistance sprang into action. Orders were sent. Troops began moving. For a few incredible hours, it seemed possible. Could this finally be the day? Then the phone rang. Hitler had survived. Someone inside the meeting had unknowingly moved the briefcase behind one of those thick oak tables only moments before the explosion. That massive block of wood absorbed much of the blast. Instead of killing Hitler, the explosion wounded him and several others, but he walked away alive. The news spread like wildfire. Within hours, the coup had collapsed. The Gestapo moved within terrifying speed. Thousands were questioned. Hundreds were arrested. Secret files were found and seized. Diaries were opened, letters were examined, and names were connected. Eventually, investigators uncovered documents leaking members of the resistance, including Hans and Diedrich, to the wide conspiracy. Diedrich had been sitting in prison for more than a year. He had taken no part in planting the bomb. He had never even entered the Wolf's Lair. But now, none of that mattered. The Nazis now understood who he really was. He was not simply a troublesome pastor. He was part of the resistance. And from that moment forward, Diedrich Bonhoeffer's fate was sealed. The bomb exploded, but Hitler had survived. And this time, the Gestapo launched the largest investigation in the history of the Third Reich. Hidden documents had been discovered, names had appeared, connections were uncovered, and among the pastors were links to the resistance network. And Dietrich was no longer merely a pastor accused of helping Jews. He was now connected to a conspiracy to overthrow and kill Adolf Hitler. He was then removed from his prison and transferred to the Gestapo high security prison. Now there was no more monthly visits, no letters, no final embrace, no chance to tell Maria goodbye. The young couple, who had hoped to spend a lifetime together, had no way of knowing their engagement would last until death, and their wedding day would never come. It's now July 27, 1945. The war is over. Germany lays in ruins. Hitler was dead. The Nazi government had collapsed. Across Germany, families began waiting for some kind of a miracle. Perhaps their sons would come home. Perhaps the prisoners would be released. Perhaps those who had disappeared into the camps had somehow survived. In the Bonhoeffer home, Karl and Paula waited. Every knock at the door made their hearts race. Every new report brought hope. Surely now they would hear something about Dietrich. Had he survived? Had he been released from prison? What about Hans? Then one day, they turned on the radio. Like so many Europeans after the war, they listened to the BBC, hoping for news from beyond the shattered borders of Germany. Instead, they heard something they never expected. The BBC was broadcasting a memorial service from Holy Trinity Church in London. It was a service honoring a German pastor, a man who had stood against Hitler, a man who remained faithful to Christ, a man the church now recognized as a martyr. His name was Dietrich Bonhoeffer. As the service continued, Karl and Paula realized the terrible truth. Their son was not coming home. He had been executed. On April 9, 1945, only weeks after Germany surrendered, the Nazis hanged him at the concentration camp. The war had ended too late. The freedom everyone had prayed for had arrived just days after Dietrich's death. The son they raised, the little boy who had learned piano beside his twin sister, the brilliant theologian, the pastor, the resistance fighter, the man who had dreamed of marrying Maria, was gone. Yet the voices from London filled the room. Another realization slowly emerged. The Nazis had succeeded in taking Dietrich's life, but they had failed to silence his witness. The government that condemned him had already fallen. The pastor they called a traitor was now being honored around the world as a faithful servant of Jesus Christ. History had already begun to revise its verdict. So what can the church learn from the life of Dietrich Bonhoeffer? First, we learn that following Jesus is sometimes costly. Dietrich could have remained in America where he was safe. He could have kept his head down, could have avoided controversy and lived a long, comfortable life. Instead, he chose obedience over comfort. Second, we learn that loving your country and worshiping your country are not the same thing. Dietrich loved Germany. His brothers fought for Germany. His father served Germany. His fiancé's father died serving Germany. Patriotism was never the problem. The problem came when the nation demanded loyalty that belonged only to Jesus Christ. Dietrich believed that governments deserve our respect, but only Jesus deserves our worship. Third, we learn that evil rarely appears all at once. It grows slowly. It begins with small compromises, with silence, with propaganda, with looking the other way because speaking up is inconvenient. Long before the concentration camps were built, people stopped defending their neighbors. Long before millions were murdered, people accepted lies about those who were different from them. Fourth, we learn that the church must never allow politics to take precedence over the gospel. Some churches became so committed to Hitler, they stopped preaching the entire Bible. Others became so afraid of politics that they refused to speak when evil stood right in front of them. Dietrich chose another path. He remained faithful to Christ above every political movement, every government, and every ideology. Finally, Dietrich reminds us that faithfulness is measured by obedience and not outcomes. From a human perspective, it looked like he failed. He was arrested. His plans to overthrow Hitler did not succeed. He never married Maria, and he died in a prison at only 39 years old. But God measures success differently. Today, the Third Reich is gone. Hitler's speeches are studied only as warnings. Yet Dietrich Bonhoeffer's books are still read around the world. His sermons still strengthen believers. His courage still inspires pastors. His life still points people to Christ. Perhaps that's the greatest lesson of all. Governments will rise and fall. Empires come and go. Dictators appear powerful for a moment, but the kingdom of God endures forever. Dietrich Bonhoeffer understood that. He gave his life for that truth. The question his story leaves us with is simple. If our generation is ever asked to choose between comfort and faithfulness, between popularity and truth, between safety and obedience, will we have the courage as he did? And what about today? Here in Canada, we have abortion at any point in the pregnancy for any reason, all paid for by our tax dollars. And many of these babies being killed are being killed because they have disabilities. Literally what Hitler did. We also, like Hitler, have a euthanasia program. Not just for someone on the brink of death. People are being killed because they have disabilities. We also have a growing Jew hatred moving across the country. Not just here in Canada, really across all Western countries. And in all of these situations, the church has either been silent or in some cases participated. It's extremely rare to hear any message in the Canadian church opposing abortion or euthanasia. And the Jew hatred is not only spreading into our churches, in many occasions the church is the one spreading it with bad theology. So today, ask yourself as a Christian, what are you being silent about? And where is God asking you to speak? If you enjoyed today's episode, make sure to subscribe on YouTube or your favorite podcast app so you don't miss an episode. We release new content every Monday. And don't forget to check out our website at lauraleesiemens.com for more information and additional resources. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week as we continue our journey through the incredible history of the church.